Welcome to Storytelling Beyond Words, New Forms of Journalism. My name is Stephen Buckley. I'll be the moderator for the panel. Let me talk a little bit about how this is all going to unfold. My colleagues here, who are going to introduce themselves in a minute, will talk a little bit about the challenge of creating new storytelling forms, and then we will spend a good chunk of time talking about some examples. And then they'll talk a little more, and we will then open up the floor for questions for the last 20 minutes or so. So without further ado, the panelists will introduce themselves.
I'm Bill Adair. I'm the editor of PolitiFact. PolitiFact is a business unit of the Tampa Bay Times, formerly the St. Petersburg Times, where I've worked for 22 years.
I'm Jim Brady. I'm editor-in-chief of Digital First Media, which operates all the newspapers owned by the Journal Register Company and Media News Group. So we have about 75 dailies and a couple of hundred weeklies.
I'm Aaron Pilhofer. I'm editor of Interactive News for the New York Times, and I run a team of, really? Nobody's ever told me to be louder, ever. Seriously? Oh, he's adjusting it.
Aaron's got laryngitis.
Yeah, I do. I have a little case of laryngitis. Anyway, I run a team of developer journalists, social media gurus, and the community team at the Times.
And I'm the dean of the faculty at the Poynter Institute, a school that teaches journalism in St. Petersburg, Florida. And so we're delighted to be here. So let's start with this question, gentlemen. Why is this such a problem? At a time when we should be flooded by new storytelling forms, why aren't we?
Well, I'll start by saying I think we are slaves to our CMSs. I think that our content management systems are so structured and rigid that they make it really difficult to create new storytelling forms. And they, of course, are really an appendage of, in the case of a newspaper, a system that is designed to put ink on paper. And so as we have added on, almost like you've added rooms to a house, we have added on features to publish on the web, but those features are essentially just taking newsprint stories and publishing them in pixels. And I think this is a real tragedy that we have this giant canvas with the web and with mobile devices, and yet we're still telling stories the same way we did 100 years ago. And so I think we very much need to think much more creatively about new forms of telling stories that will often mean breaking away from our CMSs. And in the case of PolitiFact, we did that by building our own from the ground up. And I think that's how we need to think in the digital age.
You know, I think the biggest change is just between the ears, in a way. I mean, if you think back to 20 years ago, if you were a reporter at a newspaper and you were assigned to do a story, how that story was going to be delivered was predetermined. You were writing, because that was your only option if you wrote for a paper. If you were a reporter at a TV station, it was going to be a two-minute piece. So, I mean, you didn't have to think about what's the best way to tell the story. And I think that's the hardest shift for people to make, is to take that break at some point and think, what is the best way to tell this story? Because you have all these tools at your disposal to tell it. And I think that's, we try to do a lot of training on, which is, don't just assume this is a written story and then think at the last minute about what other way we could tell this on the web. You've got to think of that at the front end. Is this a story that can be told with video, with photography, with data, via social? And I think the mindset isn't there yet, and we just have to keep working through that piece of it. Because, you know, if anybody's a horror movie fan here, I mean, the web is like the thing. It can take whatever form it wants to take, you know. I mean, you're not forced into any way of telling the story, and that scares a lot of people, as opposed to being as exciting as I think it should be. So I think as we go forward, it's all going to be about training, and about training reporters how to think about crafting the storytelling form up front.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and I'm certainly in total agreement with Bill. I would say the biggest thing that's holding us back, though, is I don't think news organizations have made an investment in getting the right people into newsrooms who are, frankly, capable of creating new story forms. Creating new story forms really, really, really hard. And it takes guts to try to do something in a completely new way. and most of the time utterly fail. I mean, utterly fails. You see occasionally newsrooms will dump something on the web, and it's, you know, frankly, a spectacular failure, including many of the projects that we work on. I am blessed to be in an organization that has made that investment, but I think over time that just has to change. We have to bring people into newsrooms who are actually capable of thinking beyond, bylined, headlined, inverted pyramid style news story.
So do you have to work for an organization with a lot of resources in order to create new storytelling forms?
I'd say no. I mean, so many of the tools that are coming out now don't require, you can do a lot of things with social, even with data, without having massive cost, having spent a lot of money on systems. So I don't think you have to. I think a lot of newsrooms, frankly, have used that as an excuse over the years. Well, I don't have the tools to actually tell stories in a different way. And I think the tools have gotten cheaper and cheaper as time has gone on. There's certainly certain things that are harder to do without a little more expensive systems. But I think if people come tell you the reason I can't tell stories more broadly is because I don't have the equipment, they're probably not being completely forthright.
No, in fact, I would say you probably need 3 people maximum. That seems to be the kind of critical mass. But even that is an investment. But you have to make it. You have to decide that we are going to go in this new direction. Otherwise, you're just doing the same old thing.
I agree. I think 3 is the magic number. The key is somebody at the top who can say, "Okay, try that." And I think there aren't enough "Okay, try that" people in journalism, in American journalism, particularly at legacy news organizations, that they've got corporate pressures and things, and so rather than "Okay, try that," it's the consultant said readers are looking for this kind of thing.
So, by way of leading into your examples, can each of you talk about the circumstances around which you've been able to create? Think about a couple of the stories you're going to talk about this morning. And talk a little bit about the circumstances around which you created those story forms.
I think advanced planning is almost always the key. Obviously, you're not always going to have that luxury in a breaking news situation, but the examples I'll go through in a little while were both cases in which we were able to spend a lot of time thinking about all the different forms that this story could take, debating which ones worked and which ones didn't work, you're trying to get into this mindset. I always use this metaphor of a carpenter. Right? A carpenter goes out and has 15 tools on his or her belt, but they don't feel the need to use all 15 of them on every story. They pick the 5 or 6 that they need for that story, and they leave the other 9 on the belt. And I think, unfortunately, in journalism, a lot of the time, people feel like, well, I have to use every tool on the belt for every story. And if you end up doing that, you're going to produce a lot of mediocre work. And so the planning process allows you to basically say, here are the 10, 12 tools we're not going to use on this story, but here are the 3 we are going to use, and we're going to kick ass on these 3. And so I think for a while we're going to have to go through that process of just stopping and thinking and going through the different tools and having that discussion. And I hope, like 2 years from now, this panel isn't even necessary, because most journalists kind of have that in the mindset. When the story comes out, they automatically kind of go to the 3 or 4 that make sense. But I don't think we're there yet, which is why the advanced planning is so necessary.
So I would say, I think it's a mindset that I'm going to use a phrase that Steve Duenas, who's the graphics editor at the Times, what he uses all the time, which is, what does it want to be? You start with this idea of, what does it want to be? How do people want to interact with this information? Sometimes it's a byline news story, and sometimes it's a crazy data visualization that has where the reporting was actually the visualization, and it's not a byline news story. So just starting, having the being able to start with that, what does it want to be? That is a small thing, but it's actually quite a large change in the way we approach reporting and writing.
My circumstance was much more personal in proposing PolitiFact. It was guilt. It was because I had covered presidential campaigns, specifically the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2004, and had passed along quotes that I suspected were probably false. And I, like a million other political reporters, felt like, well, it's not my job to fact check that. Somebody else will do that, sort of echoed more recently by David Gregory. So feeling that and also wanting to try something new in web publishing, I made the pitch, hey, let's start a fact-checking site.
Well, let's talk specifically now about the work that you all have done and work that you admire that others have done. Bill, why don't we start with you? Walk us through a couple of your examples.
Sure. So from the start, because we built PolitiFact from the ground up, built it in Django, we were able to create really what is a new story form. And so the story form, instead of being a traditional news story, is for our core feature, the Truth-O-Meter item, it is a short article that rates the accuracy of a political claim. And as we thought about the design, we weren't just thinking about, let's do a blog post. There are some other good fact checkers that do good blog posts. We wanted to do something different that was layered. So let me show you what I mean by that. So the concept of layering is we've always had an eat your vegetables approach in political journalism. You know, we're going to do the issue story and we expect you to read it to the end. And of course, hardly anybody reads the issue story to the end. And even fact-checking articles, I think, have that same sort of eat your vegetables attitude as they're written. And so our concept was, let's layer it. Let's make the homepage a place where a casual reader can come and just see at a glance what are the most recent statements that we have fact-checked. And so we have a very simple design. Our designer, Martin Frobisher, is just brilliant in his simplicity. And so the idea was, that is the person who said those words, and that is the rating. And so you don't have to read anymore if you don't want to, but you can come to the homepage and you can see the most recent statements and maybe get everything you need to know. If you want more, you can click and you can read the full article. And a full article can range from several hundred words to 1,000 words, just depending on its complexity. Let's see. And you can see we've got the Truth-O-Meter there. We have related media. If there is a YouTube video with it. And that explains why we rated it the way we did. If you want yet another layer, if you want to dig deeper, we have the sources over here on the right. We have clickable sources for everything we do. And of course, we recognize we're making a hard call here. We're gonna decide where to put the needle on the Truth-O-Meter. And you may or may not disagree. You may or may not agree with that. And so you can go to the sources and you can decide. Maybe you don't. We hope to develop a feature that will allow you to rate it yourself, where you'll be able to kind of vote and show how you feel about that particular rating. The other aspect is that we have, let me put our most favorite person here. The other thing we wanted to do was compile report cards on people. So let's take Michelle Bachmann. Even before she ran for president, was saying a lot of provocative things, and her first 13 ratings on PolitiFact were either false or pants on fire. So our report card allows you to tally up how many falses, how many pants on fires does somebody have, and then to see all of the statements that she has made. And this is what is a new form. You know, this is not just a blog post that has a meta tag on it. This is summarizing, tallying. Depending on the person, we also will put a tax on here. So if somebody attacked Michelle Bachmann, their item would be displayed here. And then you have the ability to say, show me all pants on fires by Michelle Bachmann. And so you can click and see all of those. And so that is a sort of ground-up new form of journalism that I think we all need to be doing, that we need to just invent new ways of telling stories.
So let's talk for a second about layering. How does that apply to me if I cover cops or something other than fact-checking?
Sure.
How can I?
Well, and I think that? Getting back to the eat your vegetables problem, I think we have this feeling like everybody should read the whole story, or if we're using Typepad or a blog platform, it won't necessarily display just the top. And I think as we create new story forms, if we're doing a police log, we should come up with a format in the CMS where you type a summary, where maybe you tag things, robbery, murder, and so that people can sort and look up things different ways. And the layering might be, show me all murders in Travis County, all stories about murders in Travis County, or I guess we don't know it's murder, all homicides in Travis County in the last 6 months, and be able to see a summary of those. But our CMSs don't allow us to do that.
Jim.
I'm going to talk about two examples. In a previous life, I was editor of WashingtonPost.com, and I want to talk about a few things we did there. One of them was we did a project called Pearls Before Breakfast back in, it was a Gene Weingarten story about that ended up winning Pulitzer about one of the world's great violin players who was put in the D.C. Metro for an hour and just played for an hour in the midst of kind of rush hour, with the experiment being kind of a social experiment of would people recognize genius in their midst on the way to work, and the answer, as you can probably guess, was no. But when we sat down to plan this story, we were really trying to come up with a way to help tell this story on the web in a way that would be different than it would be in print. And we talked to Gene a lot, and the original idea on the video side was, let's sit down and we'll do a traditional video piece. We'll have one of our video journalists trail Gene and track how this whole event went. And it all sounded fine, but really as we got closer to it, our video folks said, what really would be better? Let's just videotape the thing, for God's sakes. I mean, we could do a whole documentary around how this came together, or we could mount the hidden camera somewhere and actually videotape the whole hour that he played. And once we had the video, we kind of took it a step further and said, let's not do the traditional thing that says, here's the story, and by the way, when you're done reading the story, here's this kind of video you could watch. Let's combine these two things into one narrative so that we kind of want you as the consumer to read the story up to a certain point, then we want you to watch a minute of video, and then we want you to go back to the story, and then we want you to watch more video. And I think as...
So can we play? Can we go ahead and play one of the... So let me scroll through so that you all see that there are several
And these are very intentionally
here.
Visual blocks in the text. We wanted you to stop. There's more of them down farther in the story than there are at the top. There's a long story, as you can tell.
Three or four of them. And it's a brilliant story if you've never read it.
It is a brilliant story if you haven't read it. Of course. It's still there, I hope, right?
It is.
Maybe this is an old version of the story and they've taken the video.
No.
Is that a video?
It's the second. And I think there are a couple more.
Nora, looks like it's been a couple of years. Looks like a few might have dropped out in the way. But as you can see, it goes on quite a bit, but it's worth every word. But
there we go.
It is. Well, you can see, they talk about this woman who is positioned 10 feet away from Josh Bell, and she's the only person who recognizes him the entire time he's there. But he describes the encounter, and then you can actually go watch the video of the encounter, and you have good enough audio that you can hear the conversation. But we got a lot of good feedback from the readers and from other folks in journalism about you didn't separate these two forms. You basically jammed them together and said, this is one story. It might go back and forth between different types of media, but there's no reason to not combine them. We did this also with some political debates. Why have a flat quote on the web that says Obama said blah, 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 when you can show Obama actually saying it? Because inflection and how people say something carries a lot of weight. And so for debates, we would just insert the video of somebody saying something and then continue with the analysis. And this is a lot of work. I mean, you have to pick your spots on this, because doing all the video editing and embedding it, is not a five-minute process, but it really can help tell the story really effectively. And the second example is more of a teaming example of how you combine two different types of storytelling to really paint a complete picture. Every couple of years, the Post does a story about the problems with the D.C. school system. I mean, it's on clockwork. Every 3 years is going to be another series that says the D.C. school system's a problem. And when they did it in 2008 or 2009, I can't remember what year it was, we really decided we have to tell this. We can't just write another 30,000-foot story about how the D.C. school system is a problem. You have to personalize the story in a way that's going to really communicate the gravity of the issue. And so we basically FOIA'd every local school, pretty much every maintenance request, every crime that had been reported, test scores, demographic breakdowns. And we basically created a database page for every school and every public school in Washington, D.C. And you could actually go to that database, and I think if you go up to the top there, there's a data. Oh, geez, is that how it's showing up? But you really shouldn't pick old things if you're going to show, huh? Somewhere on there, in the top navigation, there's something that says data, database. Interactive map database.
Yeah. There you go. Yep.
And you could pick any school on that list and go see basically everything that had been reported about that school for the last 8 or 9 years.
There you go.
And so if you just click on the full list of schools and just click on any of those. Now it's showing up properly, of course. Nothing like live demo, right? But what you could see on this was, okay, I've read the story and I understand the big picture problem. Now I'm looking at my kid's school and I see that they filed a report 9 years ago to have asbestos taken out of the ceiling, and it still hasn't been done yet. And there were a year ago there was four violent crimes in my kid's school. And to me, it was this perfect combination of telling the 30,000-foot story, but using data to sort of tell it at a micro level and communicate the gravity of the issue much more, in my mind, effectively than you could have by doing either of them separately. The story can't really get down to the weeds, and data can't sort of weave a narrative around that tells a story. And so I think we have to do a better job in the business of trying to team different types of storytelling to paint a more complete, more effective, and more affecting display.
Jim, for both, I was going to say pearls before swine, I'm sorry, pearls before breakfast and fixing the D.C. school story, can you talk a little bit about the conversations mm-hmm. around those projects?
Sure.
How difficult was it to convince folks to do this? How'd you do it?
Gene Weingarten if you follow him on Twitter, he's hilarious. He's a great guy. Really, always embraced the web. So he really let us lead on the video piece of Pearls Before Breakfast. Obviously, the story was phenomenal, but he really trusted us to come up with a way to help communicate that story effectively. So that was a lot of discussion, but no real resistance. I think on the database side, with the print side of the paper, there wasn't an opposition to it. I just think there was a lack of, it took us a while to convince them to go as broad and as deep as we did on that. I mean, filing, getting FOIA info out of every public school is a massive effort. But, so I think you have to try to communicate, why that's so important to have, the way I just tried to earlier, is that you guys can't, everybody knows you guys are going to do this series again, and people are going to see it and roll their eyes and go, yeah, they're still not fixed yet. Okay, I'll see you in 3 years. We have to come up with a way to break the rhythm of telling the story the same way we've told it for the last 35 years. And, eventually we won that battle, and I think and that project, the D.C. Schools Project, won a Scripps Howard National Journalism Award. A large part of that in the judges' comments was because the database that was associated with it was just so complete and added a dimension to the story that couldn't be there in text. So I would say the D.C. Schools one we had to push a little bit harder on, but you have to be in the room in the beginning of the process. And I'll talk about one project, I won't go into detail on it, but the Walter Reed project that Dana Priest and Ann Hull did, when they originally put it out I think that was 09 or 08, they kept that so quiet that the website really didn't know anything about that until about three, four days before it ran. And we couldn't do anything to really support that first Walter Reed story on the web because it came so late into the process. And it was a real source of frustration for a lot of us because it was a great story. And it kind of came out of, it was really well kept, even from people inside the building. And so the second time around, we got ahead of the curve, and we were able to do a lot of good work off of that on the web. But it just goes to show you have to be in the first meeting. The digital people have to be in the first meeting about these big projects, or you're just not going to be able to get these kind of results at the end.
Great. Aaron.
So I'm going to talk about two projects. My team does a lot of projects around platforms, and we've built a lot of tools to do things that are very visual. But when we were sitting and thinking about storytelling, about the topic of this panel, two projects kind of popped out, only one of which I can take a tiny amount of credit for, the other of which I can take zero credit for. If you can pull up the 2002 elections page, Stephen.
2002.
Yeah, it's one of the five links I sent you. No? Okay, well, let's see what links you have up. Let's see. Let's start with that.
We've got the Olympics. We've got Osama.
No, I sent you an email this morning with five links. Tell you what, I'm coming over there.
Okay, come on over.
You want to sit here?
Okay. So.
That Osama is what's up right now.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. I thought you got the things. Okay.
We apologize. Sorry.
Do a soft shoe.
Jeopardy music, please.
All right. So I'm going to get to this one in a minute. This is our election. Oh, wow. You can't see that at all, can you? There we go. Can't see that at all either. All right, now we're cooking with gas. So typically when we do election results, you know, we used to do these things in very tabular form. It would be a map, there would be charts, there would be sort of like tables, things like that. But there was really no hierarchy to the information. It was all very useful, but it was hard to kind of tell a story with it. And starting with the 2008 and then continuing through 2010 elections, we wanted to try to do something a little different, and we wanted to sort of say, okay, what story do we want to tell with these numbers, and how are we going to do that visually? So we racked our brains to come up with a means, and so this is eventually what we ended up with. This was a design that Sean Carter on the graphics desk finally kind of stumbled on, and what's great about it, I think, is that it tells an immediate story in a way that we typically do not. Now, I'm going to start down here on this sort of five-column arrangement. We call this the big board, maybe in honor of Dr. Strangelove. I don't know. But but as a piece of what I really like about this is it immediately tells you what you want to know at like 1 second, 5 second, and 30 second intervals, right? There's an immediate like lead. There is a sort of a nut graph, and then there's more detail if you want it, right? So in effect, it's kind of mirroring an inverted pyramid style news story. So the lead, obviously, is the big bar across the top that on an election night would be crawling together to tell you who's ahead, who's winning what, how many seats have Democrats won, how many seats have Republicans won. And then the five columns underneath is kind of the why do I care part. Because right there in the middle is kind of the story, right? That is where the election is going to be won or lost, right? That is exactly the place you want people's attention to be focused. And so visually, that's what it does. It kind of brings you into that that center column. Now, this is not what I would say the most beautiful piece of web design. But that's not the goal all the time. I think it is an enormously beautiful piece of information design. So that's the first message I would convey is when you're sitting and thinking, what does it want to be? The whole point here is to tell a story, not to make a beautiful piece of web, not to just barf data onto the web, but to actually think about how we're going to take this data, we're going to think about it hierarchically, and we're going to end up telling a story and telling a narrative. Here's another piece that I think is amazing. Has anybody seen this before? Yeah, handful? Oh, good. All right. I'm always glad when few people raise their hand on this because I think maybe this is the most incredible infographic maybe I've ever seen. So Amanda Cox, who's also a genius data visualization specialist, she's a statistician. She's on the graphics desk. And what she wanted to do for the Olympics was to convey how close a lot of these timed events are on the Winter Olympics. Because as you're sitting and watching downhill skiing or something like that, You can see the numbers. You can see that they're a fraction of a second behind. You can see the final results. You can see that this guy got a gold medal and this guy came in 20th place. But it's hard to kind of visualize just how close that is. So she came up with this device, and I'm going to play it for you, and I hope, is sound working? Let's find out. Oh, yeah. That is always the sound you want to hear. Okay, so I'm going to play this right now. Okay, so that, what you just heard, is the difference between a gold medal and 21st place in the men's downhill. So if the top 21 skiers started and skied simultaneously down to the to the bottom of the mountain, this is how they would finish. Right? Is that not a piece of amazing storytelling? Not you. Oh. Yeah. Wow. I got to tell Amanda that. That usually is a crowd pleaser, but it rarely gets a round of applause. But again, the point is, you got to start thinking in terms of what does it want to be? What is the story you need to tell? Because you could have told this story any number of ways. And when she came across this device, I think it's like the most genius way to tell that story I've ever seen. So I'll leave it with that.
Well, no. So what kind of reaction did you get? What kind of reaction did these pieces get from your users?
Oh, I mean, amazing. I mean, they were, this one, I think, probably was one of the most popular, most viewed pieces that they did, certainly during the Olympics. And the election, I mean, and this election one, let's say when we put this out in 2008, this was kind of a new form. How do I put this delicately? You will find this sort of device all over the web now. So it has been, let's just say we're very flattered.
And you can stay there if you want.
Okay.
Can I say something?
Yeah, absolutely, Bill.
I just want to make a point that what I think is so impressive about the people at the Times, and I know some of the people that Aaron work with, is their dual skills. So you have web designers and artists who also think of themselves as journalists. And what I think is missing, and you have developers who think of themselves as journalists, and too much of the rest of us have artists who think of themselves as artists and journalists who think of themselves as journalists. And what's missing are this crossover. And to me, that's the brilliance that's when we really can create new story forms.
Well, how do you cultivate that at the Times, or do you hire for that?
Well, we hire for that, and I think on the graphics side, that's Steve Duenas again, who's been running that desk now for a number of years, and he has, 5-6 years ago, he recognized the need to become. He's always thought of graphic artists as his desk as being journalists, right? And that's not the case in a lot of places, but they are journalists. They do their own reporting. But he realized at some point that he needed to start getting more webby. And so he has gradually been bringing in people. We have a guy on the desk, Graham Roberts, who does motion graphics. So, on 9/11, maybe you saw the recreation of the Twin Towers. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's absolutely breathtaking. But we're also blessed to be able to have enough resources to have a guy who does motion graphics. But Bill, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is the key. Is when people come in and even work on my desk, I mean, they are journalists, and that's the difference.
I think it's important too that we could all sit up here and pick 5-10 things we've done in the last couple of years on the storytelling front that we think really worked, but we could all pick 15 or 20 that probably didn't. And I think part of this is you just have to take some shots. You've got to take some risks and some things that will fail. I mean, we have all done lots of projects that I always like. This is my favorite sound on my iPhone, that when you launch it, it's sort of... of course, I won't get it to work now. We put it out there and it's just a total dog, and you realize, okay, we missed the point there. We didn't merge the storytelling forms well enough. So I think you have to, none of these things happen without a lot of experimentation and a lot of misses along the way. And I think culturally we're so afraid of misses that sometimes we just don't even bother to take a shot. And I think that's why it's got to start at the top, I think, which Bill was suggesting before. If you don't have support from the people at the top of newsrooms to take experiments, getting to any of this stuff is really hard.
So talk a little bit. So what happens if you happen to be in a news organization where you're not getting a lot of love from the top to do these kinds of things? What would you all tell folks?
I've seen examples. We have, PolitiFact has 12 newspapers we partner with around the country, and I've seen examples where at a given paper they're not getting support from their chain for doing innovative stuff. So they just go rogue and do it themselves. And I've seen some great stuff like that where, hey, we've still got a URL and we can append it onto our web pages. So the heck with them, and they just do it. So I think now you can't always do that, but they've gotten away with it. I can't identify them.
Just if you have an idea that you think is a great idea and you're not getting support from the top, you know, you have to build it. You have to build it and be able to show somebody how this thing will work. You know, you can't ask, because until they can see how it works, you're just not going to get sign up. So just go rogue. It's exactly the way to go, and go in with a well oiled presentation and explanation of what you're doing, but then really just show off the work, and any good editor will be able to spot and support good work.
I mean, it didn't start out that we had a ton of support for creating a desk like the one I now run. That started out as kind of a rogue operation, and one of my co-conspirators, Jake Harris, is still with the team now, 6 years later, but Jake started in the technology shop. You know, he was one of the senior software architects, and just really actually kind of fell in love with the idea of working in the newsroom, came down, and now he's with us. Here's a tip I would start with. If you have any designs on doing things that go outside the CMS, that do this kind of that are like a little bit more kind of on the fringe, I would start in your own technology shop, and I would look around and I would find people who have a laptop like this. Look on the front. If there's a bunch of stickers on that laptop, that's the person you want, okay? That's the guy to talk to, right? And I mean guy in a unisex way. Although that is where to start. Generally, that person is going to be open to the idea of going a little bit rogue.
Can we talk a little bit, before we turn to the audience for questions, can we talk a little bit about technology? Again, if you work someplace where your bosses aren't investing a lot in technology, can you create new story forms?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've got, because of the cuts in our business, we've had, we've got the same old I don't know what they are, HPs sitting on our desks now for probably 5-6 years. So I don't think it's so much about technology as it is allowing the staff to do it. You know, because as long as you get the servers you need, you can do what you need from some pretty inexpensive laptops.
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, I think technology does play a role, but it's more, if you're saying you can't innovate in a storytelling form because you're a technology, I think that's an excuse. I think in the end, no matter what you're dealt, you know, someone used the example, I think, in some other conference I was at about, it's like the Apollo 13 situation. You have this is what you have and you need to make an oxygen system out of it. At some point, you have enough stuff laying around your newsroom that you can tell good stories. So I know others may disagree, but there may be limits to what you can do based on your technology, but the idea that I can't innovate because I don't have the technology, to me, is usually the sign of somebody who's trying to make an excuse.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Right now, there are so many tools. I mean, it is in part a technology. It is about technology, and there are so many tools out there. JavaScript libraries, Rails, Django, that make it easy for people to do, relatively easy, to do pretty amazing, innovative things. I think it's mostly in our heads that we sort of stop ourselves because we imagine that this is quite a bit harder than it really is, and it isn't. I mean, let me tell you about John Keefe. John Keefe used to basically run the newsroom at WNYC, which is the biggest public radio station in New York. He's become a nerd. I mean, he has started picking up. But he saw a lot of the stuff that people were doing, and he started hacking, just hacking. Never written a line of code in his life, and he just started hacking. On election night for the Iowa caucuses, John Keefe had the best and fastest map with the results. He was 10 to 15 minutes ahead of everybody. Why? Because John Keefe was the guy who thought, I'm going to take this Google data and I'm going to use that because Google is going to be faster than the AP. And all the rest of us idiots are sitting there watching this map that one guy put together, and we have these massive teams, and he beat everybody. So, you know, if John Keefe can pull it off, really, there's no excuse.
You know, if I could just give another example, too. I was a juror at the Pulitzer's a few years ago on the public service jury, and the paper that won was a small newspaper in Virginia, which had done a really good job of uncovering some mineral rights issues in Virginia. The reporter on that story had his hands on a lot of data, but this is a small paper with no database team. So he could have just said, well, I'll write around it. That's whatever. The guy went off, I think, tonight and basically took like a 3 or 4 day course on how to build a database.
Went to the NICAR boot camp. Plug.
There you go.
IRE NICAR, IRE.org.
Sorry. I'll collect my fee later for that setup. But the guy went off and just learned how to build a database on his own over a couple of days, came back and on his own, after doing all this reporting, built a database that went along with the story. So, I mean, you can't – even saying I don't have that skill isn't enough to hold you back if you're determined.
All right. So there is a mic right here in the aisle, the center aisle, close to the front. We'll now hear from you.
Hi. So I am from USA Today. I am not a journalist, but I am now in charge of rebuilding our Department of Interactive News Design, data visualization we call it. And we've had a really hard time actually recruiting. So we're hiring. Anybody want a job? I know that's very rare to hear, but what kind of... advice do you have for me in recruiting people for interactive news developers, and how do you find these people?
Do you want me to?
Stickers.
No, seriously, that's not a joke. I was in the same boat for a very long time, and you have to do it. You have to be proactive. You have to go find people. They're not going to come to you. We found people in all kinds of places. So I hired somebody out of a program called ITP at NYU, and they do. It's like for the most part, these are people who do art and technology. And David Nolan was there, and he's now working for me, but had never ever contemplated working in a newsroom. Just never dawned on him. And so he kind of dug the idea, and now he's part of the team. But there's really only, I have never gotten a resume through our website or through our HR department, which has a recruiter, that has resulted in a hire. It has just not happened.
And that's good to know.
So I have sourced my entire staff, and I keep doing it constantly, even when I don't have openings. I'm constantly talking to people and looking in non-traditional places. So that's the best advice I can give you.
I sent you an email, by the way, but you never responded. But.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you serious? Really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Don't worry.
This panel just got good.
I'm a flack for an elected official. What would you like to see us do to adapt to these new forms?
Well, from a PolitiFact perspective, we want you to be responsive when we're checking out a claim by your boss and be able to back up what he or she said. And you can almost tell sort of where the needle's going to go because you call the congressman's office and they'll be like, you know, hey, what's the backup material for that? And they'll give it to you really quickly. And if they do, then it's probably a sign it's going to be half true or better. But if they don't return the call, you know, it's often, and we get this with Rick Santorum's campaign, that if they don't return the call, you know, sort of, okay, that, you know, what does that tell you? And we do our best to find sources. But I would say be responsive to us in a really timely way. Of course, you know, the days of making all your return calls at 5 o'clock are over, and because everybody's publishing immediately.
I would say data, open government, give us public information as quickly as we can when we ask for it, and if there's a reason you don't think you can give it, then explain why you don't think you can give it. I think there's still a pretty wide gap among the states and local governments about what they're willing to give up. But obviously a lot of the databases that some you've seen here and others you can see by looking around on the web rely on having some base of data.
Thank you.
Hi, I work at CBC Radio in Canada on the digital side. So, on the one hand, you talked about this idea of sort of three people being this magic number, and then on the other hand, we talked about how designers and journalists and developers should really all be storytellers together in the process. So my question is sort of how do you reconcile those two things? Are those two different models, and how do you get from sort of a traditional place where you start, where you have producers, or in my case, who are really just thinking about producing audio, to a place where they're thinking about a bigger picture?
I would just go, I mean, what I've been telling all of the newsrooms that I'm overseeing now when I go visit them is you just have to, for a while, every time you're assigned a story, take 5 minutes and scribble down all the different ways that you think you could tell this story through some other format. I know it's not natural, so you almost have to force that 5 minutes, 10 minutes of just taking notes and writing down ideas. And the hope would be if you do that for 2 months, 3 months, people start doing it naturally and it becomes part of the way you think. But I don't think we can just tell people you have to think that way. I think you have to build a structure in which they start thinking that way, and you have to make it in my mind at least, you have to start with sort of an artificial construct of saying, okay, we know this is going to be an audio piece on the radio. What is it going to be on the web? And let's not even assume it's going to be audio on the web. You know, and that's, when we did stuff for WashingtonPost.com, we ended up doing a lot of projects that had no text at all. So you even have to assume that the base medium isn't going to be part of the final product. But you have to force it into the schedule or into the way you think, I think, pretty aggressively before it can become natural.
And you really need to take a hard look at your processes in the newsroom and who you're inviting to those conversations and who you're not. I mean, we had a meeting early on at the Times where, this is before the team was created, this is like 6 years ago now, where Jake and another developer came with me to a politics meeting, and one of the editors looked across the table and said, "Why are there programmers here?" You know, in a more, actually more indignant than questioning. That kind of conversation, that does not happen now. Now the question is, where is your team, Aaron? You know, at those meetings, we need to stop thinking in terms of. You are a radio person, so you are going to do audio, and audio is all you're going to do. And so, you know, again, take a look at what John is doing at WNYC. He is blazing a trail there and kind of reinventing what a public radio station should be doing on the web. I think he's incredible.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh with MSNBC.com. My question's about mobile and mobile platforms. And I guess it's a two-pronged question. One, I've got this fear that we're maybe dumbing down or self-limiting some of our storytelling methods in an attempt to make them accessible on all platforms. So I was hoping you could speak to that. And on the other hand, are you seeing some exciting things with mobile platforms to expand what storytelling is, you know, whether it's through geolocation or augmented reality or the photograph? So, and thank you.
I'll start by saying that I think it all begins with what your CMS is. And the Tampa Bay Times is getting a new CMS that is said to be much more flexible at delivering products to all different platforms. And so assuming it, and I'm not involved in that process, but assuming it delivers on that promise, I think you have to begin with a repository that has everything and can spit out different products in different ways that can make the mobile experience really good and make the web experience really good. But that begins with when you're, putting up the 2x4s about where the walls are going to be in the CMS, and you don't want to build walls that you're going to want to take down later. So I think that's the biggest first step. And I think the other thing, and we have a mobile app that we built with Adobe, and we're working on another one now. And I think we just totally need to think outside the traditional confines of how we deliver our journalism. And one thing we're trying to think about from a PolitiFact standpoint is closing the gap between the time somebody gets the message and the fact check. And so trying to develop a mobile device that may detect, you know, through voice to text, oh, Barack Obama just said preventive care saves money. pop up Truthometer false. And those sorts of things, thinking beyond just let's deliver our video product on a mobile device, or let's deliver our text product on a mobile device. I think we have to think of it as, you know, to use that same metaphor, a totally blank canvas that we can reinvent new forms, or reinvent where we can invent new forms.
Yeah, and I would just add quickly that I think, again, to go against the grain a little bit, I think there are certain projects you're going to do that are just going to be wonderful on a browser-based web that you shouldn't even bother putting on mobile, because at least on an iPhone, you're just not going to be able to experience it the same way. I don't think we should force every project onto every platform because it sounds like the right thing to do, I think. But the other half of that is you should be developing projects that are just for mobile potentially as well, especially ones that use location-based, because I think that's really the next big thing.
We've got 10 minutes left, and so I'll ask that the questions be brief and that the answers be brief.
I'm a marketing communication strategist with Kane University. We're a public institution in New Jersey with 16,000 students. We found that for our stories, commentary and social media feeds become a part of the narrative in very compelling and often surprising ways. To what extent do you gentlemen view storytelling as a collaboration with your audience, if any?
I mean, that's central. I mean, we're nothing without the audience. The audience has so many options these days on where to go to get news and information. If we don't include them in the process, we're doomed. So I think, you know, social media is a key part of how we're getting information now. We've been very aggressive at Digital First and using social media to develop stories, develop sources. You know, on the New Haven Register website, for example, every story has a link on it that's basically fact check us to go. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, if we have something wrong in the story, and you tell us, we'll put in the story that this was corrected by reader or name, you know, include the name, because we had a fact wrong in here. So I think every project you work on, every single thing you do in your newsroom has to involve the community, or else I can't possibly end well. I mean, we live in a world now in which, metaphorically, there's 80,000 newspapers on your doorstep every morning now, and there's a lot of places for people to go. So we better include them.
We're not doing enough of that in news organizations in general. Say there's a big event, South by Southwest. Now, I saw the Statesman had a ad in the print edition today that, you know, upload some video and you can help us tell the story of South by Southwest. We need to be doing a lot more of that. And I think... there's this reluctance, there's always this resistance of, you know, citizen journalists are going to overtake us, and hey, we know how to do journalism better than they do, and we need to get over that.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Cindy Royal. I teach at Texas State in San Marcos, and a lot of my students are here and former students, and I know some of you and some of the people who work for you and who have worked for you. I'm a big admirer of the projects that your teams do, and I am just interested in your thoughts on how journalism curriculum needs to change so that people can work on projects like this, so we can develop people that can work for your organizations that will meet your most pressing needs right now.
I would just say trying to get that thinking into their brains as early as possible of all the possibilities that are out there. And I will tell you that I think students coming out of the universities have a little bit more of that mindset coming out already, that there's lots of different ways to tell a story. But we still have lots of pretty young journalists coming into the newspaper. We just had one last week in one of the meetings I was in say, all this digital stuff sounds great, but I was trained in print. And you think, like, she's 24. Where did you go to school?
Not at Texas State.
In 1950? So I think it's really, you got to prepare them for all the options that are out there. And I think we're still not doing that as well as we need to.
Absolutely.
I'm actually curious how many other educators are in the room here. I'm sort of wondering. Wow, that's great. All right.
A lot.
Okay, so I think right now this is a fundamental question that you're asking, and clearly it's a tricky one. You see what's going on at Columbia. You see what's going on, you know, what Rich Gordon's done at Northwestern. There's a lot of attempts out there to try to combine disciplines. You know, Rich has been trying to bring computer scientists into journalism pretty successfully. To be honest, I mean, I think the best you can do is expose people to as much as you can and put the seed in the minds of someone who probably would have ended up in a technology shop or maybe in some other discipline that, hey, there is a place in a newsroom for me. Like I said before, the probably 50% of my staff never imagined working in a newsroom, had never set foot in the first newsroom they were ever in was the New York Times. So, you know, that is the reality. Is it's we are trying to recruit people into this business from other industries. That's the only, or from other sort of mindsets and other approaches, and that's really the only way to do it.
That's unfortunate, because we don't want you to recruit from other disciplines. We want you to recruit from our discipline, Aaron, and we can discuss this.
But we can discuss it.
We can continue this conversation with Cindy afterward. I'd like the next three folks to get in before we're done.
Amanda Peacher, I'm with Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. I'm curious to know, with these new forms of storytelling, if you're using any other measures beyond page views to determine your success for these projects.
Anytime I do any project, especially one that has a local, you got to look at engagement, especially if there's a community piece in it. I think page views are fine as a metric, but I think if you're targeting a local audience, you got to go to the loyalty metrics before the pure numbers, because those are the readers you're going to be able to get back for subsequent projects. I mean, if you're a local site. I've moved much more toward loyalty metrics than just pure page views. Pure page views are not that complicated to get for one thing, but depth is hard.
Hi, I'm Jeff Umbra. I work in book publicity, which is one of the oldest forms of storytelling. And, I mean, I have so many authors that just kind of refuse to adopt this kind of method. And I'm just kind of curious if you have any examples that I can point to of very successful interactive storytelling, or just any form of new media that you've seen successful in terms of actually selling a book or pushing an idea.
Ooh. That's a tough one. I'm the wrong person to ask.
I'll tell you one made me buy the book, Kate Boo's book about the slum in Mumbai. If you get the sample chapter on iBooks, it comes with a video that she had shot with her iPhone of the slum, and that was sort of that sold me. It was like I saw that, and she had in the enhanced edition of the book, there are several videos that she shot or that she let the kids of the slum shoot, and it's just put in various places in the book where it should be, like Jim's example, and it's simple. It's video mixed with text, but it was really powerful because it put face and voices to the characters of the book.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm head of digital design at the Times in London. I just wanted to ask what people thought about whether we have to restructure our newsrooms, focusing away from the traditional literary editor lead towards a more story production kind of system that involves graphics, multimedia, and whether anybody's had any experience of restructuring a department in that way, where that focus moves away from traditional editors and more towards producers of stories.
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes. Of course, I would say that.
Yeah.
You know, and we're actually struggling right now with the question of process, right? So what we have actually become is a software shop, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're building software now in the newsroom. And we have no process that is in place to accommodate that, to sort of understand. We understand stories. We don't understand how to build big websites like this,
yeah,
right? And so we're now in the process of trying to figure that out. I don't think anyone really has, but the answer is absolutely yes.
Cool. I would just add to that. I mean, our philosophy at obviously digital first media is a bit of a tip off, I guess, to our strategy. But we're really trying to convert. We don't make newspapers; we make stories, and those stories have to live in lots of different forms. And we have to stop considering ourselves a newspaper company, because that's just not the way we can keep going. So all newsrooms have to change to become places that create journalism, create stories, and where they end up is, a different story.
All right. You've been an awesome audience. Thank you so much for your great questions and your patience. If you've got more questions, feel free to ask afterwards.